Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Thanks, Stuart Holme, for joining us this hour. Really happy to have you here with us tonight. We've got a lot of news to get to tonight, including some late-breaking news that I'm going to give you in just a second as we're trying to get details. I have to tell you, just tonight, NBC News has obtained this remarkable video from security cameras at a dance hall in Alhambra, California. This is from Saturday night this weekend. You see the man in the knit cap there. This is Saturday night. It's just after that man you saw there in the knit cap. This is just after he's believed to have walked into a dance hall, a ballroom dancing studio in Monterey Park, California, and opened fire. At that dance hall in Monterey Park, he shot at least 20 people, 11 of whom have now died, 9 of whom are now still hospitalized with their injuries. The suspected gunman got away. After that massacre in Monterey Park, he then drove to this facility that you see here in Alhambra, California. And this is a room, what appears to be sort of a foyer at a second dance hall, another ballroom dancing facility, basically, just a few miles away from the Monterey Park massacre in the city of Alhambra, California. Now, you see there's, can we drop the Chiron there? Yes, you can see that more closely. The man without the hat on is 26-year-old Brandon Tsay. His last name is T-S-A-Y. He did not know when this man walked in the door of his workplace carrying this gun that that man had just committed a massacre minutes before at a different facility. Brandon Tsay was at work. He was unarmed himself, but he saw that man walk into his workplace holding this gun. And Mr. Tsay rushed at the man. He wrestled with him, as you see in this footage. He fought with him. He single-handedly, as an unarmed person, got this gun away from the man in this, who you can see here with his back to the camera wearing the knit cap. Brandon Tsay basically got the gun, wrestled with the man for a long time. This went on for longer than a minute. He then essentially chased him out of the facility. You can see him here pointing at the man, telling him to go, holding the man's gun away from him. In doing this, in overpowering the man, getting his gun off of him, and then chasing him out of this facility, Brandon Tsay presumably saved many more lives that might have otherwise been lost this Saturday night. The man who he chased out of that facility was found by police the next afternoon in a van, dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. But 26-year-old Brandon Tsay is being hailed by L.A. police tonight as a brave man who saved many lives. Again, he himself was unarmed when he just reacted, ran at this guy, managed to take this guy's gun off of him. It itself is remarkable that Brandon Tsay didn't shoot the man. He said he threatened to shoot the man, but he did not. He kept the guy's gun himself and chased him off, and he called the cops. Congresswoman Judy Chu represents Monterey Park, California, where the massacre took place this weekend. She's from Monterey Park. She served on the city council there. She served as Monterey Park's mayor. Congresswoman Judy Chu is going to join us live here tonight in just a moment. I mentioned at the very top that we are following some news that's just breaking right now. We are just getting word, I'm sorry to say, of another apparent mass shooting in California tonight. Initial reports are that 7 people have been killed in the Half Moon Bay area in California. Half Moon Bay is just immediately south of the San Francisco Bay Area on the California coast. What we are learning tonight is that 4 people have been shot and killed at one site, and another 3 people were shot and killed at a second nearby site. The suspected shooter is reportedly in custody. He's being described as a 67-year-old Asian male. The 7 victims are being described tonight by a city council person from Half Moon Bay. They're being described as Chinese farm workers. But again, that is word of just one local council person from Half Moon Bay. We are pursuing more information on that story. But again, this is just terrible news out of Half Moon Bay, California tonight. Authorities are saying they do have a suspect in custody and that they therefore believe there is no additional threat to the public tonight in Half Moon Bay. But seven people are reportedly dead. Authorities are asking asking the public to avoid Highway 92 between Highway 1 and Highway 35 in Half Moon Bay as this investigation tonight continues. Again, two different sites, seven people found dead already. Now, at this point, we do not have any indication of any possible link between this mass shooting in Northern California tonight, Half Moon Bay, as I said, just south of the San Francisco Bay Area on the California coast. We don't know of any link between this shooting in Half Moon Bay and the Saturday night shooting in Southern California. But with 11 people dead in Southern California, seven people dead in Northern California over a 72-hour period, it appears to be Asian Americans targeted in both cases. It's obviously very disturbing. As I said, Congresswoman Judy Chu, who represents the Monterey Park area in Southern California, is going to be joining us live in just a few moments. But we will let you know more as we learn more with this developing story. I have to tell you, we have something new to report this hour on a story that I admit we have not spent much time covering before now, even though you have undoubtedly heard a lot about it. Ever since the North Shore Leader, a small newspaper in Long Island, New York, was first to break the news, and then ultimately the New York Times broke it wide open. Ever since those papers started the reporting on a newly elected Republican congressman named George Santos, there's just been a hurricane of coverage about the amazing number of fake stories he appears to have made up about himself, the also amazing number of con jobs he appears to have been involved in his young life. It's just become this astonishing litany. I mean, he apparently lied about where he went to high school. He lied about where he went to college. Then he lied about going to a different college. For one of the colleges he lied about, he also lied and said he was a volleyball star there. Why would you even lie about that? He lied about having an MBA. He lied about working at a Wall Street firm. He lied about working at a Wall Street bank. He lied about being a landlord with more than a dozen properties in his family real estate portfolio. He lied about being the employer of not one, not two, but four separate people who he says were killed in the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando in 2016. He lied about creating an animal charity. He lied about his mother being in the South Tower at the World Trade Center on 9/11. He lied about his grandparents escaping the Holocaust. He lied about himself being Jewish. He also lied about himself being Ukrainian. I mean, and that's not all, but that's a flavor of it. And it shows you the amount of coverage there's been about this story already. This is, nevertheless, the new Republican congressman from the 3rd Congressional District in New York State. Kevin McCarthy just gave Mr. Santos a seat on the Small Business Committee and also the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, which shows you just how much the new Republican Congress values those concepts, right? Put George Santos in charge of national policymaking on those subjects. Now, to be fair, he did get on the Space Committee by telling Kevin McCarthy he was an astronaut. And I mean, why is there any reason to doubt it? But as I said, this is not a story that I have spent a lot of time on, mostly, honestly, because it's just had plenty of other coverage from all quarters since it started unspooling in all this astonishing detail. But tonight, I am going to talk about this story for the first time. Tonight, we do, for the first time, actually have something new to add to this story, video that we have obtained exclusively in which Republican Congressman George Santos adds yet another astonishing claim to his big, long list of all the rest of them. We have obtained video in which Congressman George Santos says he is the victim of an attempted murder that resulted in him being put under police protection because the murderer might come back for him after missing him the first time. Also, he says in this video that someone stole his shoes in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York City, specifically at the corner of 55th Street and Fifth Avenue at 3 p.m., somebody took his shoes. Not the same people who were trying to murder him. Apparently, that was separate, but who can say? In any case, that's coming up tonight. We will have that for you in a moment. I don't exactly consider it to be like a major contribution to the news of the world, but it is new. We will show you that. There's also some real national security news on a couple different fronts out of Washington today. First, as amazing as it is to say, there have been four more convictions on seditious conspiracy charges connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And I say this is astonishing because people don't get convicted of seditious conspiracy very often. The Washington Post, I think, got this exactly right tonight when they described seditious conspiracy charges as, quote, rarely used and even more rarely successful. That has been true for the last 80 years or so in the United States. But the way things are going with the Justice Department right now, that kind of assessment may need to be revised. I mean, before now, before the Trump era and the January 6th attack, Americans really were only charged with something as serious as sedition very, very rarely. And when the government did try to bring charges that serious, they repeatedly found it very hard to get a conviction. I, for example, just did a whole podcast series called Ultra about the biggest sedition trial in U.S. history in 1944. Those defendants were variously caught, like, building bombs and stealing weapons from the U.S. military and planning armed violent attacks and assassinations to overthrow the U.S. government. And they were taking instruction and funding from the Hitler government in Berlin. I mean, the various defendants in that 1944 sedition trial were caught doing all this stuff. And that sedition trial still collapsed in failure. And all the defendants got away and just melted back into the sauce of American ultra-right extremism. The history of charging people with sedition, it really has been a severely uphill thing for the U.S. Justice Department throughout modern U.S. history. But apparently that's changing now in the wake of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Less than 2 months ago, two leaders of a pro-Trump right-wing paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, were convicted of seditious conspiracy, as shocking as it was. Now tonight, less than 2 months later, another four members of the Oath Keepers were also convicted on those same charges. And that shows not only that the Justice Department is getting to be increasingly adept at getting convictions for charges that serious, it shows that both the leadership and the rank and file members of these Trump paramilitaries are proving to be vulnerable to this very, very serious charge. The Oath Keepers guys who were convicted today included at least one guy who took part in that military-style stack formation that moved through the crowd of the rioters up the steps of the Capitol to go breach the Capitol building. At least one member of that military stack was among those convicted today of seditious conspiracy. The men convicted of seditious conspiracy today also include another guy who was overseeing the huge arsenal of guns and ammunition that the Oath Keepers had stashed at a Virginia motel just across the Potomac from D.C. It was what they called a quick reaction force. They wanted those guns to be able to be rushed into D.C. whenever the Oath Keepers decided it was time to start the shooting. One of the guys who was overseeing that arsenal at the hotel was also convicted of seditious conspiracy today. In total, though, it's six different members of the Oath Keepers who are now convicted by juries of seditious conspiracy in two different trials. And there may be more of these guys to come. Five members of a different pro-Trump paramilitary group, five members of the Proud Boys, are still on trial in the same federal courthouse where the Oath Keepers were convicted today. The Proud Boys are facing seditious conspiracy charges as well. That case is still underway. I mean, among other things, what this means for the history of this era is that efforts, particularly on the political right, to dismiss the attack on the Capitol as a prank or as something that sort of went awry or an accident or something that's been overblown, those efforts to basically excuse what happened on January 6th. Throughout history, those efforts will butt up against the hard, cold fact that in at least two different jury trials, juries have found people who participated in that event to have participated in an effort to overthrow the U.S. government by force, which is what sedition means. So at least we're getting the history of it right, despite efforts already to try to whitewash it. The other big national security story we're following tonight is an absolutely shocking arrest and indictment of a senior FBI counterintelligence official. I mean, this story is legitimately shocking. Do you remember the name Oleg Deripaska from the Mueller investigation, from all the mishigas around Paul Manafort, the now convicted felon who served as campaign chairman for the Trump campaign in 2016? The name Oleg Deripaska is, you know, it's a Russian name. It can be sometimes, if you're not as familiar with a lot of different Russian names, it can be hard to remember these things. I feel like he is one of the more memorable ones, if only because we heard his name so many times amid the whole Russia scandal. When we learned in the lead up to the 2016 election that Russia was messing with our election to try to help Trump get elected, I mean, one of the single most bananas revelations of that whole time period, it was more bananas than that photo of Trump's national security advisor sitting at a table with Putin in Russia at an event for which a Russian propaganda agency paid him thousands of dollars to be there. It was more bananas than the revelation that even though Trump said he had no business dealings in Russia, on the night of the third Republican presidential candidates debate, Trump secretly signed a letter of intent to build the biggest real estate project of his life in Moscow. The revelation about Oleg Deripaska was more bananas than all of that. For me, in terms of like revelatory moments in the middle of that scandal, this still sticks out to me as the one that was the most astonishing thing to learn in the moment that I learned it. It was March 2017, an Associated Press report. So this is a public report after we had already learned in 2016 that Russia had intervened in our election in every way they could to try to get Trump into the White House. In March 2017, this AP report crossed the wires saying that Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, had been paid on a multi-million dollar annual multi-year contract to promote the interests of the Putin government in the United States and around the world. I mean, the guy running the Trump campaign, while Russia's trying to get him elected, that guy is on a multi-million dollar annual contract to promote Putin's interest? How is this? Yeah, the man reportedly paying Manafort to promote the Kremlin's interests in the United States was an oligarch close to Vladimir Putin named Oleg Deripaska. Oleg Deripaska and Paul Manafort were in business together in various ways for years and years and years. Oleg Deripaska is all over the Mueller report. His name appears in the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee report on what Russia did in the 2016 election. Deripaska's name is in that report more than 300 times. Oleg Deripaska ended up getting sanctioned by the U.S. government for his key role in Russia's efforts to mess with the 2016 U.S. election. That's Oleg Deripaska. And now look at tonight's headline, The New York Times. Former top FBI official in New York charged with aiding oligarch. Prosecutors say Charles McGonigal, who was chief of counterintelligence in New York City, worked secretly for Oleg Deripaska. We've got a picture on the front page of the New York Times of Oleg Deripaska. Again, he's back for the craziest of all possible reasons. I mean, here's the headline in the Washington Post tonight. Former senior FBI official accused of working for Russian he investigated. Charles McGonigal, former counterintelligence chief, is charged with money laundering and other counts connected to oligarch Oleg Deripaska. McGonigal was a senior counterintelligence official at FBI headquarters until late 2016, just before the 2016 election in October 2016. They moved him from FBI headquarters to the New York field office to be the special agent in charge of counterintelligence there. McGonigal was arrested this weekend at JFK Airport in New York. They indicted him today in D.C., for taking hundreds of thousands of dollars from an Albanian intelligence officer while he was on the job at FBI headquarters in D.C. They also indicted him in New York, where he's charged with being on Oleg Deripaska's payroll and also with taking steps to hide it. Because, of course, Deripaska is sanctioned by the U.S. government, so nobody in the United States should be in business with him anymore. Charles McGonigal retired from the FBI after 22 years in 2018. 2018 is the same year Deripaska was sanctioned by the U.S. government. McGonigal is charged with being on Deripaska's payroll, basically through a law firm starting in 2019 and then eventually getting paid by Deripaska directly starting in 2021. Deripaska was criminally charged with evading sanctions last year The FBI raided two homes associated with Deripaska, both in New York and D.C. But, I mean, what of that investigation now? Because now this special agent in charge, this senior FBI official who supervised and participated in investigations of role in Russian oligarchs, including Deripaska, now he is charged with secretly working for that same guy and secretly taking money from him. As the Times notes tonight, this shows, among other things, that the reach of Russia's oligarchs can extend even into the heart of U.S. law enforcement. These revelations and these indictments also raise huge questions about the incredibly sensitive counterintelligence information that this FBI official had access to. I mean, he was a very senior counterintelligence official. Among other things, he was reportedly the lead FBI investigator looking into why it was that U.S. intelligence assets were getting arrested and murdered in China all of a sudden. I mean, these are people who were losing their lives to work with our country. The guy charged with investigating how it was that they were being exposed and how it was that they were starting to get murdered. He himself was allegedly being paid by foreign governments and spies. I only know what I read in the spy books and what I read in the indictments, but from a national security perspective, this seems very bad. It also just seems very, very unusual. Joining us now is someone who really does know these things, and not just from spy novels. Mary McCord served as the top national security official at the U.S. Department of Justice. She's now executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown Law School. Mary McCord, it's a real pleasure and an honor to have you here tonight. Thank you for taking time.
Thank you for having me.
First, let me just ask you if what I just described about the McGonigal case is fair. Just looking at this as a lay observer, as somebody who reads the news and can read the public-facing documents here, it just seems like this must be an incredibly rare and unusual thing. I mean, this is a senior FBI official from the counterintelligence side of things, charged with being paid by people he was investigating and people with ties to foreign governments and foreign intelligence services. This seems like kind of a unicorn case.
Well, you know, any time that you have a law enforcement official at any level, federal, state, local, who abuses the trust placed in them by virtue of their position, you know, that's a very bad thing. And it's very dangerous for public safety. And it really erodes the feeling of Americans and the ability to have faith in their law enforcement. But this is magnified so many times because this is just an astonishing abuse of that trust when you're talking about somebody who's not only betraying his office and putting Americans at risk in terms of public safety here in the U.S. He is actually doing this on behalf of foreign adversaries. And this is somebody who, through his job, was cleared, I'm sure, at the very highest levels in terms of our classified information, privy to sensitive information about intelligence collection, about what adversaries such as Putin and the Russian government, such as in some cases the Chinese government, privy to the various tactics and techniques that they've utilized to meddle in various U.S. affairs. And this is somebody who'd had access to all of that. And now to learn that not only did he betray that trust after he left the FBI, but also while he was still in the FBI, it's really staggering. And I'm very glad to see that the department and the FBI has come down hard on him. And with indictments in two different jurisdictions for multiple crimes, serious crimes. And you're right, I've not seen this very often. So far, there's no Espionage Act charges, and I hope there never will be, because I hope there'll never be any evidence that he actually provided the information he was privy to any of our foreign adversaries. But this is very, very serious in so many ways.
Now, I should mention that Charles McGonigal did plead not guilty to the charges filed against him in New York. If he is found guilty, if he is convicted based on the statutory the sentences associated with the statutes under which he's charged, he's looking at potentially decades in prison. And it's serious for all the reasons that you described. I do find myself wondering today, though, whether or not he is convicted. Is this potentially a problem for any of the counterintelligence prosecutions that he played a role in? For example, just when it comes to Oleg Deripaska, we know that the FBI raided homes associated with Mr. Deripaska last year. We know that he's been charged with trying to evade sanctions. We also now know that Mr. McGonigal, who was involved in the Deripaska investigation in cases related to him, as well as other oligarchs, it has been allegedly compromised in multiple ways. Does that potentially blow up some of the cases or all of the cases that he was involved in during his time in the FBI?
Well, I'd add to that that the D.C. indictment also alleges that he was being paid by someone who later was actually a cooperating witness, a witness for in an investigation he was engaged in. So it gets, you know, the plot even thickens. But you're right. The Department of Justice will be now doing an analysis of cases that Mr. McGonigal had a hand in, either as a supervisor or as an investigator, and will be looking carefully to see if there is any compromise or any Brady information. That would be information that the government is obligated to provide to defendants who've been charged with crimes where he may have, had a hand. They'll be looking to see if there's anything they need to disclose, whether they need to dismiss cases, and of course, whether even in past cases there's anything they might need to disclose. Now, I will say this: in counterintelligence, unlike so many other areas of the FBI's work, much of that work does not actually result in criminal cases. The counterintelligence agents that I worked with, they would have been the first people to say to you, "We don't really want any of our cases to end in charges. We want to keep acquiring the intelligence that we need to try to keep the U.S. safe from national security threats from our adversaries." And so it's not the area where you see many, many, many charges. You don't even see nearly as many as you see with respect to counterterrorism and terrorism cases, and certainly nothing like what you see in other sort of run-of-the-mill criminal cases, even conspiracies, even white-collar conspiracies and drug conspiracies. Those are areas of the FBI that are much more focused on investigating a crime for a charging decision. Counterintelligence is about long-term investigations, understanding the tools and techniques of our adversaries so that we can better counter those threats.
Which has this sort of, it's a good news, bad news thing in terms of potentially blowing up any charge, any cases that actually were charged and made their way to court, but also has potentially long-term and international consequences in terms of, as you say, in terms of national security. Mary McCord, who served as acting assistant attorney general for national security at the Department of Justice, now at Georgetown Law School. Ms. McCord, thank you very much for your time and your expertise tonight. It's really invaluable to have you here.
You're welcome.
All right. We've got much more ahead here tonight, including, as I mentioned, that video we have obtained where Congressman George Santos makes yet another astonishing claim to add to the list. This is exclusive dash you haven't seen anywhere else. We've got that next. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
So at the top of the show, I went through a long but definitely not exhaustive list of the known lies of freshman Republican Congressman George Santos of New York. You're probably familiar with some of the greatest hits by now, the volleyball star and Wall Street fortune and all that stuff, right? But here's something you have not heard before. Did you know that Congressman George Santos also claims he was the target of an assassination attempt, which required him being put under official police protection? That is what George Santos claimed last month in an interview with a Brazilian podcast. The podcast is called Radio Novelo Apresenta. Forgive my pronunciation, Radio Novelo Apresenta. They shared this video from the interview exclusively with us. So you won't see this anywhere else, but I want you to see it. In this interview, then Congressman-elect George Santos is speaking with the hosts in Portuguese. So we have subtitled it. He starts off talking about an alleged act of vandalism, which he says was targeted at him simply because he's a Republican. But then in the midst of that, he says, oh, also someone tried to murder him.
Em janeiro de 2021, a minha casa sofreu vandalismo. Meu marido e eu, a gente tinha ido para uma festa de fim de ano, em 2020, na Flórida. Vou para uma festa de Réveillon com meu marido, a gente volta à nossa casa, foi vandalizada porque a gente estava numa festa republicana na Flórida, em dezembro de 2020. Então, é aquilo, eu já sofri vandalismo, a gente já sofreu atentado de vida, atentado de assassinato, carta ameaçadora, ter que ter polícia, escolta de polícia parada na frente da nossa casa.
We have already suffered an attempt on my life, an assassination attempt. There was an assassination attempt, really. Then Congressman-elect George Santos did not elaborate on his claim in the interview. We have tonight reached out to Congressman Santos's office to get more information about him saying that he was the victim of an attempted murder, getting New York police protection at his home as a result. There ought to be a record of that sort of thing if it happened. We've inquired about this claim from him. We have not heard back. We do live in hope. Mr. Santos did offer more detail about a different act of violence he says was committed against him. In this interview with the same Brazilian podcast, he said he was the victim of a very, very, very brazen mugging. In the middle of the day, in the middle of New York, one of New York City's busiest thoroughfares.
No verão de 2021, no meio da Quinta Avenida com a 55, eu fui assaltado por dois homens. Antes que qualquer pergunte, não foram negros, eram brancos, inclusive, mas eles me assaltaram, levaram a minha pasta, levaram o meu sapato e o meu relógio. E isso foi na luz do dia. Eram 3:00 PM, eu estava saindo do meu escritório, indo para a garagem pegar meu carro, e eu fui assaltado. A minha casa foi violada, foi...
Eles arrancaram o seu sapato em plena Quinta Avenida?
Sim, em plena Quinta Avenida. E o pior de tudo não foi isso, ninguém fez nada. Ninguém fez nada. O medo é real, é surreal que a gente vive aqui.
It is surreal what we live through here. Yes, surreal is one word for it. I love that the podcast host interrupts him there. Santos says, it was 3:00 PM, I was leaving my office, going to the garage, getting my car, and I was mugged. They robbed me, took my briefcase, took my shoes and my watch. The host then interrupts him and says, they stole your shoes? In the middle of Fifth Avenue? Really? The podcast hosts actually say they later asked George Santos for the police report for his mugging on the corner of Fifth Avenue and 55th Street at 3 p.m. in the middle of the day when they took, among other things, his shoes. But they say they never heard back from him when they asked for the police report. We have also asked Congressman Santos's office for that police report. We will let you know if we hear anything. We've also put in a records request with the NYPD for any police report that matches what Mr. Santos described. We live in hope. But perhaps the most magnificent moment of this interview comes when Congressman Santos tries to explain to these podcast hosts why it is that he personally takes such a hard line toward undocumented immigrants when he himself comes from a family of immigrants. Watch.
Por isso que eu sou assiduamente crítico de pessoas que querem iniciar o seu sonho americano e aquela jornada e querem ensinar ela de forma errônea. Eu acho assim, os Estados Unidos foi criado em imigração. Foi criado em imigração, em diversidade. Eu incentivo extremamente as pessoas que querem vir para cá a fazer. Mas eu também incentivo que isso seja feito de forma correta. Porque eu acho assim, imagina você iniciar um relacionamento com uma mentira. Ou com fazendo uma coisa errada, né? Então, eu acho que não é beneficente nem para mim, nem para você, né, nesse relacionamento. Então, eu também...
I'm assiduously critical of people who want to start their American dream the wrong way. Imagine starting a relationship with a lie. Imagine starting a relationship with a lie. Imagine how awful that would be. Because, of course, he would never lie. Your Republican Congress at work. Republican Congressman George Santos. We will be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We have breaking news tonight of the sort that is hard to take. Tonight in Half Moon Bay, California, which is about 40 minutes south of San Francisco, authorities say 7 people have been shot and killed. Another person injured. Local sheriff's office is saying these shootings took place at 2 different places. 4 shooting victims found in one, 3 more victims found in another. 2 nearby sites, they believe it was the same shooter in both mass killings. Authorities say they have a suspect in custody. They're identifying him as a 67-year-old man named Zhao Chun Li. They say they found him in his vehicle outside a sheriff's office substation. They say they do not believe there is an ongoing threat to the public. Again, a suspect in custody in conjunction with what appears to be 7 murders in Half Moon Bay. One member of the Half Moon Bay City Council is telling the local press that the victims in this case, all 7 victims, are Chinese farm workers. Again, that is attributable to a Half Moon Bay City Council person, and we are trying to chase that down further. But we're talking about 2 big mass shootings, 2 gun massacres in the same state in less than 48 hours, both targeting Asian Americans, with an astonishing 18 people dead between these incidents. As I said, this is just absolutely gut-wrenching. This news from Half Moon Bay tonight follows the dreadful news from Monterey Park, California, near Los Angeles this weekend. After a long Chinese Lunar New Year celebration on Saturday in Monterey Park at 10:20 p.m. on Saturday night, a shooter entered into a ballroom dance studio less than a block away from where the Lunar New Year festival had been held in Monterey Park. He opened fire. He killed 10 people on the spot, wounded another 10. We have learned today that one of the people who was wounded in the attack since has died at the hospital. That brings the death toll from this attack in Monterey Park to 11, with, again, 9 people still injured and hospitalized. That same shooter apparently then went to a second ballroom dance studio about 10 minutes north in Alhambra. There, a 26-year-old who was working at the front desk somehow managed to wrestle the gun away from the shooter. He himself was unarmed, but he charged at the shooter and wrestled with him and fought with him and got the gun away and chased the man away and called the police. Sunday morning, the police identified the shooter's van. They surrounded it, but before they could get to him, he apparently shot himself inside the van. Authorities have identified that man as a 72-year-old man. A man named Hu Con Tran is identified as the shooter. He was reportedly a regular at the dance halls, which are a popular spot for older residents in Monterey Park. We don't know of any motive yet, but law enforcement tells the LA Times that Mr. Tran had recently shown up at his local police station making allegations of fraud and theft and saying his family had tried to poison him. We don't know what to make of that, but tonight there are 18 families in California grieving their loved ones. Joining us now is California Congresswoman, Chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, Judy Chu. Congresswoman Chu, thank you for being with us tonight. I know this is a really, really, really dark time.
I am now doubly horrified after hearing about what happened at Half Moon Bay. I didn't think that I could even have the capacity for being doubly horrified, but I just cannot believe that all this is happening.
Yeah. And to be clear, we don't know of any link between these two incidents. There's nothing that we have seen to suggest that these two things are connected. But obviously, the Asian American community in California has to be absolutely reeling and terrified. There's something that is in a multiplicative way terrifying about multiple incidents targeting Asian Americans in such close proximity. You're such an important Asian American leader and political leader, broadly speaking, in California right now. I just wonder if people sort of looking for solace, looking for leadership from you right now, what you have to tell them about the fear that people are understandably feeling.
Well, it has been a tough 24 hours here. When I first heard about the shooting, it was 6 a.m. yesterday, and I immediately went to the Monterey Park City Hall to find out what was happening. Fortunately, there were so many in law enforcement that came and worked to find the shooter and to find out what happened. But the loss of life was just absolutely stunning. Nonetheless, people in the community were terrified because the shooter was still loose. They didn't know if they could go to their Lunar New Year celebrations in other places and whether the shooter would also kill them. They didn't know if they could send their kids to school. Well, finally, at 5 p.m. yesterday, the sheriff announced that the suspect had been caught and that he had killed himself. And we did breathe a sigh of relief. But what I've been telling the community is you are safe. This killer is no longer alive. And it is important for us to come together as a community. First of all, we have to truly support the families of those who were killed and also those who are still trying to recover, some of whom have very, very serious injuries. We have to make sure that they have the financial means to be able to survive this, but also the emotional support. And so there is actually a vigil tonight and tomorrow night, as well as a GoFundMe site that will do exactly that. But we also have to come together as a community. We need to support one another because this is a fearful time, an anxious time. But I believe that this community is resilient and that if we work together, if we come together, we will be stronger and we will get through this.
You have such a long history in Monterey Park, having served on the city council there, having served as mayor there, having been involved in activism there when there was, I remember, racist organizing in the 80s in the area, trying to have English declared as the official language, trying to single out Monterey Park and as some sort of threat to white communities as a community that was emerging as an Asian American stronghold. In terms of supporting the families directly affected here, can you tell us if all of the families have been notified now in terms of their loved ones who have been killed or who have been injured? Are there still people in Monterey Park who are waiting for news? Or does everybody at this point know and it's a matter of recovery?
Well, we went to the crisis center this afternoon. And as of that time, there was one family yet still to have get the legal notification. So I felt that they were well on the way to having them all legally notified. But I want to tell you that the news of this is so devastating that actually they had to bring the paramedics out because one family just could not handle it. So, yeah, it's so sad. The families right now are kind of in a fog. I mean, it's just hard to comprehend all of this that is changing their lives so drastically. So that's why they need the support. They need the whole community to be behind them.
California Congresswoman, Chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, Congresswoman Judy Chu. We're so sorry for the loss in your community. Thank you for being with us tonight. And in terms of what your community needs in terms of national support, people will be looking to you to convey that to the country, and the community is lucky to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for this. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back. Appreciate it. Tomorrow at noon Eastern time, a very important and potentially very interesting court hearing is going to get underway in Atlanta, Georgia. This is the hearing where a judge is going to hear arguments about whether we, the public, should get access to a report that was recently completed by a special grand jury that was convened in Fulton County, Georgia. The special grand jury has been investigating whether laws were broken when former President Trump and his allies pressured elections officials to change the results of the presidential election in Georgia and to send Congress forged documents related to presidential electors from the state of Georgia. This special grand jury did an 8-month-long investigation as to whether or not laws were broken in those over the course of those events. 2 weeks ago, they wrapped up their work. They wrote a final report on their findings. Tomorrow, a judge will decide if that report will be released to the public or whether it will be kept under wraps, while the Fulton County District Attorney makes her decision on whether she is, in fact, going to seek indictments. There's a group of media organizations that have filed a brief with the court arguing that the report should be made public. The judge overseeing the case said the special grand jury itself wants the report to be made public. But we don't know what the district attorney is going to ask of the court, and we don't know what the judge is going to decide. But that hearing will start at noon Eastern in Atlanta tomorrow. Should be fascinating. Watch this space. Okay, I'm done, but you for sure want to watch Lawrence tonight. For sure. There are 3 Democrats in Congress who Republicans are apparently going to try to block from serving on committees. In this next hour, Lawrence is going to have all 3 of those Democrats on live. Also, Ruben Gallego, Congressman, combat veteran, Marine, progressive Democrat. Gallego announced today he's going to challenge incumbent Senator Kyrsten Sinema for her seat in the Senate now that she has dropped out of the Democratic Party, which should be a battle royale.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.